Session number 11736, Mr. Stephen Pete, Reel 7.
Stephen Pete, Reel 7. Pete, Reel 7. So, relief then. Oh, yes. Yes.
The feeling of relief at that being taken a prisoner, I don't think it lasted all that long. So there we were in Stalag 17A, on the near the Hungarian frontier, in this village of Kaisersteinbruck in Austria, we were. And every day, one half of the camp was for Russian prisoners. And they didn't have Red Cross supplies. They had the very meager, basic, or less than basic rations. And we were a double thickness of barbed wire with a kind of roadway distance between us, where we were in that part of the camp and where they were. And every day we would see corpses of prisoners who had died being loaded onto a cart and taken out of the camp. We attempted to get food to them, get some of our own supplies to them without success. I'm sorry to say there was a Catholic priest who was there who had some special status in the room to himself, and he wouldn't help in any way. And so that was a terrible sight to see, and occasionally we tried to throw things, and that did in some ways more harm than good, because they were so far gone with hunger they'd fought and pushed each other against the barbed wire. It was dreadful. I saw at one point, when I don't know why I was in another part of the camp, must have been with a guard fetching some things, a kindly old Austrian guard come in with a briefcase under his arm into one part of the Russian compound and took a loaf of bread out, and he was mobbed and he had to be rescued. About 10 years ago, I was in Austria and with the help of some Austrian friends went back to that village and to the site of the camp, which is now or was Austrian military camp for present day conscripts, and if they have conscripts in Austria, I think, and went with the officer of that camp to where this huge prison camp had been, and was told that it had 10,000 prisoners. I had no idea it was as big as that, of all sorts. And saw the site of the whole hillside with the sort of concrete remains of where these barracks had been. And I asked him about the Russians' prisoners and how I'd seen them being carted away every day. And he said, oh, well, they would have been taken to the mass grave at the other side of this village. So we went over there and saw, in effect, the other half of the story I just told you, where they must have been taken every day. It was a whole field with a great monument just saying mass grave of Russian soldiers. I don't know how many hundreds, thousands must have been in there. That was very upsetting. I didn't know what to do. I picked two or three little dandelions and put them in my address book that I happened to have in my pocket under the letter R, which they stayed for some months. But it shocked the Austrian family I was with too, not unnaturally, seeing that, and they had no idea. And then, while in that camp, We managed to keep ourselves busy one way or another. I wrote a little play and one or two short stories, and then one day, this whole account is full of then one days and then suddenly. I think it was about April 1944. A group of us were taken to on another train journey. And it must have been quite a small group from that camp, and the others must have come from other camps, to be part of about 40 medical orderlies of different sorts, who appeared to be going to be the staff of a special camp. But the journey to get there was across to the middle of Germany. It must have been 2 days or so, I suppose. Again in a train, but quite comfortable, comparatively comfortable, and a most agreeable Austrian officer took us, who was either a solicitor or a lawyer, hating being in the army, and a very pleasant man. And we, when we arrived where we were going, we stood in a little semicircle, and he came and shook hands goodbye and wished us luck. It was a lovely break from the rather appalling conditions we had been in. And it turned out to be a camp which had a number 4D, Stalag 4D, or otherwise it was called Heilag 4D, which I think is short for Heimgenlager, a repatriation camp. A repatriation camp in English. Which was housed in a great big building. I don't know what it had been, something rather like a hospital or a huge school or something like this, with lots of big rooms which were used as wards, and lots of wooden barracks at the back and barbed wire around the whole thing, in a small town, right inside the town, with houses backing onto the wire, with people in the gardens, all very strange. And what happened was, it was turned out to be a place where 4 lots of badly wounded and sick prisoners, English and or British and American, were brought, who had been deemed unsuitable for military service and were being returned to their countries in exchange for the same number of German prisoners. And 4 of these repatriations took place through this camp, which was a hospital, because many of them were fairly badly sick or wounded or mentally ill too. And they would come to the camp, and that's what happened between then, April 44, and the end of the war, near the end of the war. They came to the camp, would be looked after there for a few weeks or a month or two until the Red Cross trains arrived, took them away, and then we had free time till another lot began to build up the numbers in the camp. That, in very broad detail, is what happened there.
And you had the job, did you, of looking after them?
Yes, we had specific jobs there. There was an English doctor and anaesthetist. In fact, the medical, senior medical people changed once or twice. There was an English doctor called Dr. Sylvester, brother of the band leader, I remember. I don't remember the names of the others. Yes, we had jobs. You know, there was kitchens, it was a hospital, in fact. It was a hospital that filled up to capacity and beyond, and then emptied. And when it was empty, we were taken out on walks. We had a picnic once, believe it or not, a mushroom expedition. The thing was, and again the senior medical officer said to us, as you can see, this is an easy camp to escape from. There wasn't double barbed wire and electric fences and machine guns. There were 2 or 3, in fact, old or disabled guards there patrolling the grounds outside. He said anybody could get out of here, and I cannot forbid anybody to do this, but please don't. It might muck up the entire repatriation scheme if something, this kind of thing happens, or worse to this effect, a careful speech. And nobody did leave or go. except, in fact, one mental patient who climbed over the wire one afternoon in broad daylight, shows how easy it was, and ran a couple of days before the trains were due, and got to the next village, was in American uniform, was challenged by a German soldier correctly three times, and then he shot and unfortunately killed him with a shot. And then there was a tribunal. This was about February 45, a tribunal as to whose fault it was. The British medical orderly had let him get away out of the ward when he was a mental case, or the German soldier who had shot him, and they were both exonerated as both behaving correctly, because as they had to be. And he just proved that he was seriously deranged to do a thing like that at that minute. Although I believe one or two of the mental cases were people who had got into a dreadful state because of being repatriated. One I know was an Air Force man who brought his plane down, unharmed or something like this, and had become sick and was on this repatriation. He was scared of going back to face a court-martial. But on the whole, there were, except one or two, who had somehow managed to fool the Swiss and Swedish doctors that they were sick when they weren't. And then they'd have to prove that they weren't sick when they got back. That was a difficult thing. It was very hard work when they were. I think it was up to 800 people in this place, and it was a small staff for that number of sick. So we had periods of very hard medical work, and there were operations and all sorts of things. A pleasant time. I did various things extra, like running a library, or two or three of us did, and again with music, and we got a gramophone, and we had plays and concerts, rather like traditional Hollywood idea of a prison camp. And now, there was one remarkable man, really remarkable man, called Dr. Wolfgang Uhlig. U-H-L-I-G. Wolf-Dieter Uhlig. That's right, Dr. Wolf-Dieter Uhlig. He was the German medical doctor assigned to be the German medical doctor in the camp, working alongside the English doctors there, looking after these people. And he lived in a flat in two streets away. And his wife, she was a nurse, he had managed to wangle to get her working in the local hospital. There's a little town called Annaberg, about 20 miles northeast of Torgau, where the Russians and American armies met, it so happens. So we were to the east of that. Anyway, I got to know him because when he went on his rounds, I don't know how I fell to my lot to trot along beside him and taking notes and things. We became friends, and he would work out various little things, like he'd say, look, I've got to take this heavy typewriter or this box of bandages or something over to the local hospital, and could you carry them for me, and I'll see you all right through the gate. And so I'd trot along with him, which was perfectly all right, a German officer, and he took charge of me. And then he'd look right and left, and he'd say, pfft, and we'd pop into his flat and go and have some ersatz coffee and a biscuit with his wife there. This was marvellous for whatever it was, 20 minutes in an ordinary household. It was absolutely wonderful. And then we'd necessarily have to go on our business again. So I got to know him well, and he was much liked by all the staff of the camp. And when any of us had some ailment, we always went to him for treatment rather than the English doctors. I'm explaining all this for something that happened in a minute. When very late on in the war, there were instructions came that army officers should use the Nazi salute. Interestingly enough, it wasn't until very late on they used a military salute. It put him in a fix. He was already as near as he damn well dared. Was an open anti-Nazi. But, you know, he didn't dare be completely open because he didn't know who was informers in the camp. But the way he dealt with it was marvellous. The day the new law came in, I saw him coming in the gate of the camp with his right arm in a sling, pretending he'd hurt it. So when he was given the Nazi salute by the guard, he just went like this. And he couldn't use his right arm for some days. And when, I'll just tell you one more story about Dr. Uli. When at the end of the war, and by that time, and the last repatriation had taken place, lots and lots and lots of prisoners were being marched from the east in advance of the Russian armies, American and English prisoners. We became a staging post, and in fact, near the last few weeks of the war, the camp filled up to something like 3,000 people were crammed in. Some sick we were looking after, and the rest were ordinary prisoners. And then the Russians arrived. He and his wife came from Hanover. He came into the camp and said, "Could I bring my wife? And if you could give us English uniform, lend us English uniform, can we march out of the camp with you when all the prisoners go? Because we don't want to get caught here with the Russians." And not a single person, you know, he did it openly, made any objection. He was so liked. And extraordinary. There he came with his wife, with a head shaved, looking like a man. And off they went. And when we got back to England, going again ahead a little bit, one of the things in the debriefing, or whatever it's called, was to, if you wished, you've given a piece of paper answering lots of questions, you could blacklist anybody that you wanted to report as having behaved atrociously, or whitelist. And I said, I wrote his name on the white list. I heard from his wife, we kept in touch, I had their address in Hanover, that he was very quickly given the job of being medical supervisor of displaced persons camp somewhere, in a very senior job, and worked himself to death. He got typhus and died. It was very sad. He almost worked himself to death in our camp, I remember. He had flu at one time and went on working and working and working. He was a very remarkable man. We met his wife in near Hanover a few years later, just to renew acquaintance.
Did he know that you were a CO?
Oh, yeah. We talked about everything, I'm sure. I mean, when I say I became a friend of his, we all did. But as I said, I remember trotting around with him, and trotting is the right word because he went everywhere at huge speed, doing so much. I became his kind of unofficial assistant for a bit. I'm sure he did, yes.
I wonder if it was something you knew that was meant, you spoke about.
I don't remember. But we had did I have the FAU flashes on my shoulders? I wonder. I'm not sure.
I'm wondering, really. You know,
I might have managed to keep them. Otherwise, I would have just had whatever I'd been issued with. We got issued with great coats and trousers and shirts most of the time, or in the summer. And in fact, at the end of the war, we just wore a pair of shorts and some boots. Yeah, but I don't remember anything. I'm just interested in him as a remarkable man, and somebody who meant a great deal in the camp to a great many people. And this business of defying authority up to the as safe as it could be. Now,
I was wondering, you know, if I could just put in a question. Yes. Here, and I don't wish to interrupt your flow.
No.
But I was wondering, you know, if the fact that you were COs, if it made any difference being a prisoner, do you think, to the ordinary army, to your sort of perception of your situation? Would you, for instance, you see, you wouldn't have had, I imagine, this concept of the enemy, of being the prisoner of the enemy, as perhaps soldiers might have had.
Some soldiers. The business of, like, helping with those boy soldiers not get into trouble, this is the thing that everybody was thinking the same way, including myself. We didn't want to get them into trouble for a double reason. Firstly, they were nice, agreeable young men, doing something they hated doing, probably. And it'd be a muddled mixture of not getting them into trouble and not getting ourselves into discomfort, as would have happened if they'd been found like that. And probably would have got the door slammed of the coach and not allowed to keep it open and all the rest of it. So it was a mixed feelings. And I think, yes, I know what you mean. And again, I was observing as well as participating. Right at the end of the war, an extraordinarily friendly but repulsive German officer who was in and out of this repatriation camp, trying to catch people out by things he said and did. He was an expert pianist, and he'd come in and play on the piano and then happened to mention some piece of factual war news that we could have only known if we had a secret radio, saying something like bad news about the fall of so-and-so. And if he caught somebody agreeing with him, instead of saying, good God, has that place fallen, there'd be an immediate raid on the camp, searching every bunk and every corner for the radio. I don't know where it was hidden, but we did have one. He was repulsive and very easy to get on with, a bull person. At the end of the war, I found him in tears just before he disappeared, when the Russians were just about to arrive and things were falling to pieces, saying, you know, I really believed the Führer had a secret weapon and this wasn't going to happen. I believe I'm wrong, and my whole world has fallen about me. I felt quite sorry for him, but very glad to see him go. I'm not actually answering your question, but yes, I must admit, at times I felt I was standing back from any kind of conflict that I was personally involved in, but I think a great many prisoners got into this state.
The other prisoners as well, you know, and presumably mostly REMC.
Yes.
Am I right in thinking that still?
Yes.
Yes. Your relations with them, would you know your conscientious objection, would that have come up at all?
I don't remember doing so.
When you were talking about Dresden earlier.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we could talk about this now.
Sure.
You know, this is going now towards the later stages of the
yes.
war, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the time at Dresden, I mentioned it before, but when all these planes flew over and over and over and, you know, on and on and on, what felt like day and night, I think it was day and night in actual fact, for a day and a night and a day. And at that moment, and the shouting and the elation died down, I think a great many people were feeling the same way. That that this was too much, this was really awful. And the camp commandant, he lost his family there, and he came back on duty, and you know, there were all sorts of very, very mixed, upset emotions there. And so we were all in the same boat. There was another time we were all in the same boat, very much, was before each of these repatriations of these trainloads of people that we helped onto these Red Cross trains. They went off either to Switzerland or to the north coast, and then they crossed to Sweden and exchanged in either of those two countries, I believe. And it also was a way of sending news back to England. We sent back surreptitious letters with other people, so I got news back home through this method, and I met again, or we met again, Major Till and Captain Dornan, and a couple of FAU people who had been prisoners who came back on a repatriation, who had been taken prisoner in Greece, way 41. Where was I? Oh, yes. A day, it was always one day before the trains arrived, a list went up on the notice board of the 10 out of the 40 medical staff, medical orderly staff of the camp, the 10 who were chosen to travel back with the trains and who would be back in England within a few days. And four times this happened, and that list went up, and you didn't know until the list went up whether you'd be back home in a few days or you'd still be in the camp, and maybe forever. You mean maybe you'd never be home. And this was, when looking at scenes recently, here we are in October 1990, of people in Baghdad with the planes flying in and not knowing whether they're going to be on the next plane home or whether they're going to be in Baghdad forever or maybe bombed to pieces. I felt very much the same emotions of watching and seeing those people as we had each time. The first time was the worst, and after that we got used to it, and by the luck of the draw, Dennis Westbrook and I were never on one of these repatriations. I don't know how they did it, with a pin or something or names in a hat. That was a trying time, which everybody, again, on the staff had the same difficulty, and those of us who had to remain felt very much drawn together. Yeah, we didn't. The business of being Army or FAU disappeared by then completely, I'm sure. The much more important thing were the tiny niggles of everyday life that erupted occasionally into a small fight of no importance, because you had to burst out sometimes. You know, couldn't stand the way a colleague of mine called Dennis Westbrook cut up his processed cheese exactly in shape to put on his 2.5 pieces of bread that we got every day, or whatever the amount was, and he'd spend spent ages like a jigsaw puzzle, to the extent of me wanting to scream. These are the kind of things I'm thinking of, which is totally unimportant.
You were talking about communication, you know, using this as a means of communication, the repatriation. What was the situation regarding the FAU organisation? Had they got in touch with you? You know, were you communicating with them?
Yeah, I had. We all had, I forget the ration of letters. There was special communication. I've got actually all my letters both ways. I mean, from home, or most of them, ones that turned up and the ones that I sent home. There was special communication through Geneva first,